Today is June the 19th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. The United States Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, known as CISA, has gone public with a warning to Microsoft Windows users regarding a critical security vulnerability. By issuing the update now, CISA has joined the likes of Microsoft itself and the National Security Agency, NSA, in warning Windows users of the danger from the Blue Keep vulnerability. It is predicted that it would only be a matter of weeks before the attackers started exploiting Blue Keep. Blue Keep is a software security vulnerability affecting computers using older versions of Microsoft Windows operating system. That is to say, Windows 8 and Windows 10 are not affected at all. This warning applies to Windows XP and 7 users. Microsoft issued patches last month, but as many as 1 million devices remain vulnerable. Most of the private exploits targeting Blue Keep would have triggered a denial of service condition capable of knocking computers offline, but an exploit able to remotely run code or malware on an affected computer. Researchers have already revealed that just under 1 million internet-facing machines are vulnerable to Blue Keep on port 3389 used by the Microsoft Remote Desktop feature. But that's just the tip of this insecurity iceberg. There are 1 million gateways to potentially in which many millions more machines that sit on the internal networks they lead to. A wormable exploit can move laterally within that network, rapidly spreading to anything and everything it can infect in order to replicate and spread. Here's the real stinger to it. That can include machines in an Active Directory domain, even if there's no Blue Keep vulnerability to exploit. The machine running the vulnerable remote desktop protocol is merely the gateway. Once compromised, the clever money is on an incident that could become as widespread. In other words, you may be running Windows 10 and 8 that are not affected, but if it's part of a network of which you have Windows 7 and XP running, the worm can affect even the machines that are not vulnerable. So there is a patch available. Get to the patch. Make sure it's implemented. Apple wants to win back its Mac Pro audience. Apple to release redesigned Mac Pro, a desktop computer that had earlier built a reputation as a workhorse for creative professionals. Customers who relied on the product line for their processor-intensive jobs, such as video and audio editing, many found the 2013 model inflexible and not suited to their work. Apple made clear that it is determined to win back that long-neglected target market. Apple unveiled a redesigned Mac Pro. The new tower, which consists of a stainless steel frame, housed in an aluminum cover, the model is suited to customization, repairs, and replacement parts. Apple boasted while introducing the device, "It's the most configurable, the most expandable, and the most powerful Mac Pro they've ever made." The technical specifications encompasses the latest and greatest of available component parts. It's the price, however, that has gotten the attention from the journalistic press. Apple's new Mac Pro will go on sale in September. The starting price tag is $5,999. It's pretty steep even without all the extra bells and whistles, which adding a matching monitor, the 6K 32-inch Pro Display XDR adds an additional $4,999 just for the monitor. And the stand for the monitor doesn't function, other than holding up the stand is $999. Then you have the wheels for the portability. It's optional. And if you want to max the configuration, the all-in price is $35,000. The company is working to win back a niche audience that is essential to the Apple brand, imbuing the company with a cachet of the creative class. The prediction is there won't be long lines queued up waiting for the doors to open to buy the unit. And if it's in short supply, you'll probably only have to wait 6 to 12 months to buy the new improved model at a lower price. Apple is making it clear that the company has reprioritized form follows function. And anyone who can afford to pay $5,000 for a Mac New Pro can expect to pay a lot more if they want the full kit. While the price tag of the Apple's new tech will already be eye-watering for some, the tech giant are also charging $990 for a stand to put it on. Anyone who can afford to pay $5,000 for Apple's new Mac Pro can expect to pay a lot more if they want the full kit. While the price tag for the Apple's new tech will already be eye-watering for some, the tech giant is also charging $999 for a stand to put it on. Added to the $5,000 for a Mac Pro monitor, the total cost be a staggering $12,000 just for the startup. And that's for the basic unit. Apple would only charge $1,000 for a stand to display it on like a piece of art. Apple says goodbye to iTunes on the Mac. Apple has officially begun closing the chapter on iTunes after 18 long years. Apple announced that Catalina, the next version of the Mac OS, would omit iTunes in favor of three separate desktop apps: Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, and Apple TV. An all-encompassing hub like iTunes just started to feel, well, a little bit overwhelming, because Apple even poked fun at the laundry list of capabilities it tacked onto iTunes over the years and said the team was considering adding a calendar, a web browser, and email functionality to the app. For the longest time, iTunes dominated the digital download space with the 99-cent tracks from top artists from around the world. As the years went on, though, streaming services became the preferred way to access entertainment, and the need to buy to own platforms like iTunes seems, well, much less valuable. Beyond its entertainment capabilities, iTunes is also known for its ability to sync and manage devices. With the platform out of commission, users will now perform these functions within the sidebar located in Finder. Previous purchases and libraries will be maintained in each new app on Mac computers. Apple also noted they do not currently have any plans to end support for iTunes on Windows, though that might change in the unforeseeable future. And Windows users could also be forced to download Apple's trio of apps. Google researchers confirmed criminals in 2017 managed to get an advanced backdoor pre-installed on Android devices before they left the factories of the manufacturers. Triada first came to light in 2016 in articles published by Kaspersky, which said that the malware was one of the most advanced mobile Trojan the security firm's analysts had ever encountered. Once installed, Triada's chief purpose was to install apps that could be used to send spam and display ads. It employed an impressive set of tools, including rooting exploits that bypassed security protections built into Android and the means to modify the Android OS. That meant the malware could directly impair every installed app. Triada also connected to no fewer than 17 commands and control servers. Google stopped short of naming the manufacturers, The report also said the supply chain attack was pulled off by one or more partners the manufacturers use in preparing the final firmware image used in the affected devices. Triada infects the device system images through a third party during the production process. Sometimes OEMs want to include features that aren't part of the Android open source project, such as Face Unlock. The OEM might partner with a third party that can develop the desired feature and send the whole system image to that vendor for development. Based on analysis, they believe that a vendor using the name Yehuo, that's Y-E-H-U-O, or Blazefire, B-L-A-Z-E-F-I-R-E, infected the return system image with Triada. By the way, Triada is spelled T-R-I-A-D-A. The post also expanded on previous analysis of the features that made Triada so sophisticated. The backdoor also injected code that allowed it to use the Google Play app to download and install apps of the attacker's choice. The downloaded and installed apps use the package names of unpopular apps available on Google Play. They didn't have any relation to the apps on Google Play apart from the same package name. So if you see any particular app that you're not familiar with, delete it. And if it's really something that you hardly use, just reinstall it after you deleted it. Triada seems to be a relatively advanced piece of malware. The developers resorted to the supply chain attack after Google implemented measures that successfully beat back the backdoor. One was mitigations that prevented its routing mechanism from working. A second measure was improvements in Google Play Protect that allowed the company to remotely disinfect compromised phones. The Triada version that came pre-installed sometimes in 2017 didn't contain the routing capabilities. The new version was inconspicuously included in the system image as third-party code. For additional features requested by the OEMs, Google has since worked with the manufacturers to ensure the malicious app was removed from the firmware image. Last year, Google implemented a program that requires manufacturers to submit new or updated build images to a build test suite. One of these security tests scans for pre-installed potentially harmful applications included in the system image. If they find one on the build, they work with the OEM partner to remediate and remove the harmful app from the build before it can be offered to users. The report acknowledges that as Google tightens security in one area, attackers are sure to adapt by exploiting new weaknesses. The Triada case is a good example of how Android malware authors are becoming more adept. This case also shows that it's harder now to infect Android devices, especially if the malware author requires privilege elevation. Facebook is planning to launch GlobalCoin next year across a dozen countries. Facebook's crypto token is set to continue as it eyes a first quarter 2020 launch, according to a BBC report. The social media giant is now said to be finalizing plans for its global coin and will begin testing later this year, before launching it in around a dozen countries as a challenger to banks, with the token rumored to be used for payments via messaging apps that they have. You don't have to be a Facebook user to use it, though. The BBC also reported that Facebook had been in talks with the U.S. Treasury and the Bank of England about its crypto plan. The next step, it said, is to confirm liquidity providers and exchange to store and trade the asset, with the firm reportedly in talks with Gemini and Coinbase. The coin has been in the making for months. Facebook had been ramping up its hiring efforts to build a blockchain team of over 30 people by the end of 2018, working at breakneck speed, according to the New York Times. More news is expected soon, with the BBC adding that Facebook is expected to launch its rumored stablecoin network in the coming weeks. The current project started last year with Facebook confirming it was exploring the options within blockchain. According to a report of the New York Times earlier this year, more than 50 people have been working secretly on the Facebook project, operating from a building that is not accessible for other Facebook employees. On May 2nd of this year, Facebook officially registered the company Libra Networks in Geneva, Switzerland. Libra will provide financial and technology services and develop related hardware and software. The Independent reports that Facebook's cryptocurrency project has been nicknamed Project Libra. What is the use of the global coin? Although there are not many details out on what global coin will be used for, it is highly likely global coin will be used for payments both within and outside the Facebook ecosystem. According to the BBC report, Facebook is in talks with a number of online merchants to accept the currency as payment in return for lower transaction fees. It is also expected that global coin will be used on platforms such as WhatsApp, Messenger, and Instagram, owned by Facebook, to allow people without a bank account to transfer value to each other through the Facebook ecosystem. Global coin will likely be a stable coin pegged to different currencies, such as the dollar, the yen, and the euro. What is Facebook trying to achieve? Or the bigger question is, why won't Facebook just use another cryptocurrency? Or even Bitcoin? It looks like Facebook is trying to disrupt Bitcoin by teaming up with banks and governments. Yes, Facebook and banks trying to disrupt Bitcoin that is trying to disrupt the banks. With Bitcoin not being supported by the banking industry and large governments, Facebook is trying to get the traditional partners on their side. Mark Zuckerberg met with the Bank of England and also got in touch with officials from the U.S. Treasury. Next to that, Facebook is in talks with money transfer firms such as Western Union. Everyone who doesn't like Bitcoin because decentralization is scary can come to Facebook for their shot of centralization. That brings us to the pros and cons of global coin, as there are mixed reactions in the crypto community to the plans of Facebook. First, the con. It's centralized as hell. With decentralization as a core value of Bitcoin and many other cryptocurrencies, it's easy to say that Facebook's cryptocurrency cannot be named cryptocurrency at all. Different projects playing in different leagues. Yes, global coin will operate on the blockchain, but Facebook will have full power over the network. Data, not safe. Anonymity, none. Safety, none. A vulnerability in Facebook wouldn't be the first and would expose global coin. The U.S. Senate Banking Committee have raised questions about global coin's consumer privacy for a reason. But most important, a lot of the core value Bitcoin and cryptocurrency have, global coin doesn't share. What are the pros? 2.4 billion people. As a blockchain researcher points out in the BBC report, global coin could be one of the most significant events in the short history of cryptocurrencies. With only an estimated 30 million users in crypto and 2.4 billion monthly users on Facebook, the world of cryptocurrency will open up to a large part of the world with the introduction of global coin. So yes, global coin is not decentralized and impossible to compare with Bitcoin in many ways. But it can provide the gateway to Bitcoin and all other cryptocurrencies for billions of people. Once they made the first step through Facebook, a whole new world of true cryptocurrencies will open to them. Facebook has had a lot of problems with security and privacy. Let me ask this question. Do you think that with global coin, they are going to make sure that privacy and security is in the best interest of the consumer? Or are you just a product? Presenting home automation, Marty Winston, replacing those damn power strips.
Something I decided that I thought I should share with you so you could at least think about it. It will be a while, or maybe never, before I can absolutely enforce this everywhere across the house we moved into in April. But I'm determined to eliminate a couple of all-too-familiar entities from among the places we plug things into the wall. I want to get rid of power strips, and I want to get rid of outlet multipliers. In their place, I want to have enough hard-wired outlets wherever I need them that I'll never miss those power strips or outlet multipliers. As we retrofit this old house, I've already had the electricians install 40 new two-gang boxes. Each gang takes a duplex receptacle. That's two receptacles per duplex times two gangs per box times 40 boxes. 160 added outlets. Really, closer to 150 because a few are special purpose single gang installations, but still 150 additional outlets. Maybe you think that's overkill. Take a look around you. At my desktop, I have a system unit, two monitors, a 6-port USB charger, a 7-port USB 3 hub, and an LED desk lamp so far. Most of that isn't using those outlets per se. I have 7 backup power supplies under the desk. Actually, it's now 8, and those are plugged into the outlets, and my desktop devices plugged into those. But sparsely. The lower the load on a UPS, the longer it keeps running during an outage. Also, when I added a whole house surge suppressor, I became free to ignore that the little surge protectors in outlet strips and even the ones in each UPS can fail with no way for you to know it. There's a table behind me that I use as a credenza, and we're putting 2 rows of outlets on the walls next to it. One line of outlets is the standard hammer length high off the floor, and the other level is about 6 inches above the tabletop. The lower level is for the printer and its UPS, one for the rollabout rack cart that has its own UPS inside, along with, in that rack cart, the cable modem, the router, the Ethernet switch, the UMA phone connection, the cable system phone connection, a TiVo box, a rechargeable flashlight, and a few other odds and ends, but just one power cord coming out of the bottom. We'll plug some other things into the lower level, things we don't expect to unplug very often, like the power adapter for our indoor-outdoor thermometer. The tabletop-level outlets are for things that are likely to be less permanent, like chargers or wall warts for the products we have into review, and probably the battery chargers for our cameras. One difference between real outlets and power strips is that you'll never accidentally kick a real outlet out of the way, and you're much less likely to trip over a cord that's plugged into the wall than the one at the end of a power strip. Outlet multipliers have several challenges, even those from good manufacturers. Too many adapters can be heavy enough to make the whole cluster pull loose from its socket. Too many outlets can present too big a temptation to plug in too many devices, ultimately overloading something. Even if you have 12-gauge wiring on a 20-amp breaker, you'll get into trouble if you plug in too many toasters, hair dryers, or space heaters. And by the way, it may be a 20-amp breaker and a wall plug that's good for it, but did you bother to check the rating of the outlet multiplier? Most are 12 to 15 amps. Do you enjoy the smell of plastic cooking? Anyway, that's me and my priorities. Make your own decisions. You probably won't die or burn the place down. Probably.
Thank you, Marty. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. This week, he's going to talk about customer relationship management software.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and this is the time where we start talking about the IT professional. And in this week, I'm actually going down a different road. It's a tricky topic, and I'm going to try my best to stay on the IT professional aspects of this, allowing you to learn about a particular type of software, but also venture into a direction where I'm going to comment on something that it's a stance that's being made that's kind of disturbing. Now, let's say I am a mattress seller, and all of a sudden, a software manufacturer tells me that I cannot sell mattresses because some guy might cheat on his wife. Now, the software company in particular here that I'm talking about is Salesforce, and I'll get to that part of it later. But what they are is they are a company that creates the software that tracks all of my customer information. Now, what we're talking about is customer relationship management software, or CRM. CRM is a key software that is really important in any kind of business that is trying to do business in today's connected society. CRM is used by a number of companies, and it's because they are engaging and learning how customer patterns work. These packages all provide a level of reminder or tickler for the sales guys, and they do an automated calling system for others that will drive the sales further. And we've actually dealt with these before, even if you and I don't know about this. Now, some of these track social media sites, some of these track and provide details on geolocation. What is that? That's where someone is. The numbers of usage are actually kind of interesting. 91% of all companies over 11 employees are using customer relationship management software. It's sold to them based on tracking sales, improving repeat business, developing relationships, and improving them. In short, yes, CRM, customer relationship management software, keeps the wheels of companies moving. Now, we can look at some of the giants. We can look at Facebook and Google and how they use similar tactics. But the big winner in this CRM game is Amazon, who has marketable products unlike Facebook and Google. All right. Now, Google and Facebook are taking part in some of this, but really, Amazon, their own business is driving people to purchase new gadgets and more. The return on investment is said that for every dollar on email marketing that is spent, there is a $40 return. Okay, let me underscore this. Let's say I send an email to all of my customers and it costs me $1,000 to do that. The return on investment, I will make $40,000. Now, companies used to think about this as just driving more sales, but recently they've noted that selling marketing and service automations and analytics are able to develop new strategies. Now, these new strategies can predict all kinds of different improvements within the company that are going to increase success. So this moves more than just customer relationships. It's starting to get to a point where we can start to predict what our customers going to be doing in the future. What are the different trends that we need to be doing and following as a major company? You follow me there? So this isn't just some little, okay, we're just tracking who the customers are. We're putting them into a database and then we call them up once in a while. No, it's telling us, what are they buying? What are they likely to buy in 5 years? What are they likely to buy in 10 years? Now, because of the importance of this software, companies are spending millions of dollars on CRM because it drives that much business. Now, changing a software like this for any company regularly costs about twice the annual amount. All right. Now, an ERP software implementation will soak up your profit for a year or longer. CRM software packages are very similar. And even worse, a CRM changeover costs more than just the profit amount, just the dollar amount, because there's a lot of various trending analysis, a lot of historical data and more that's kept there. This is an important software to not only have, but for you to stick with the same company for years on end. Camping World, I found this out recently, pays $1.2 million annually to that company called Salesforce. Now, I open up with the idea that another company telling me that I can't perform a legal business like selling mattresses because someone might misuse them. Salesforce actually recently told Camping World, and actually all of their clients, that they cannot use the Salesforce customer relationship management software to drive sales of firearms. Okay, now that's a legal business as well. And I don't care where you sit. This is not an issue of firearms. This is an issue of legal items. Selling legal items is being banned. Selling items that are constitutionally protected. Now, there may be some of you that applaud Salesforce, but I ask you to consider again the idea that any company that can change the rules and put you out of a legal business because they don't like that business is a major problem. For instance, you sell sodas and sweets. That's leading to the obesity of millions. Let's shut you down. You sell to minorities. That's banned. Costing you all of your profit for a year or two. That's actually a constitutionally protected area, but I'll go to a more direct one because this is a computer topic. Selling computers or designing and making websites. Nope, we're not going to support that because we don't like you having First Amendment or anybody having First Amendment protections. We're going to ban you from doing business. This entire approach to corporate bullying is something we're also stuck with, and it will continue until we have no freedoms. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. A historic Supreme Court ruling on public access television. First, a little background. In the United States, public access television is an alternative system of television which originated as a response to disenchantment with the commercial broadcasting system and in order to fulfill some of the social potential of cable television. Public access television is traditionally a form of non-commercial mass media where the general public can create content television programming which is narrowcast through the cable TV specialty channels. Public access television was created in the United States between 1969 and 1971 by the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, under Chairman Dean Burch, based on pioneering work and advocacy of George Stoney, Red Burns, and Sidney Dean, and they're from New York City. Public access television is often grouped with public, educational, and government access television channels under the acronym of PEG, P-E-G. PEG channels are typically only available on cable television systems. So what's the case that came before the Supreme Court? A public access station operated by Manhattan Neighborhood Network, that's MNN in New York City, Manhattan, suspended two contributors from using the station's services and facilities for allegedly harassing and inciting violence against other MNN employees. The contributors then filed a lawsuit claiming that MNN was violating their First Amendment rights. The First Amendment only applies to state actors. By state actors, it refers to government employees of the government. And the district court ruled that MNN was not a state actor. The Second Circuit Court disagreed, ruling that MNN was a state actor. So the issue is, whether the Second Circuit erred in rejecting this court's state actor test and instead creating a per se rule that private operators of public access channels are state actors subject to constitutional liability. Whether the Second Circuit erred in holding, contrary to the Sixth and D.C. Circuits, that private entities operating public access television stations are state actors for constitutional purposes where the state has no control over the public entity's board or operations. Well, let me put this in lay term, okay? It varies throughout the United States how public access television is organized. In the case of New York City, there are five public access boards, each representing their respective borough. In the case of Manhattan, you have the Manhattan Neighborhood Network representing Manhattan. You have Queens Public Access Television representing Queens, and so on. And in this case, these five organizations deal directly with the cable channel operators and receive funding directly from the cable channel operators. This is different on how other public access television are organized in the United States. For instance, in Great Neck, which is our neighbor in New York City, the funding goes through the government of Great Neck. And because it goes through the government of Great Neck, the funding is processed through, and I use the term filtered because it's always less than what was given, to the operations. In this case, the people running the public access channels for Great Neck are state actors. In the case where the public access channels receive funding directly from the cable operators, these are considered to be private actors or private separate from the government. And there lies the crux of the case. The outcome on June the 17th, which just was the other day, the court reversed in part and remanded the case. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote the 5-4 opinion, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor dissented, joined by Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and Elena Kagan. What does it mean? The United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, ruled Monday that a private operator of a public access channel was not a state actor for the purposes of First Amendment restraint on speech, and remanded a case to the district court, in other words, where the case was originally held. Justice Sotomayor issued a dissent in the case, and you can find that ruling elsewhere online. Significantly, the majority opinion did not accept the Internet and Television Association amicus argument that all PEG channels are unconstitutional, and ruled narrowly on the case itself. This is a victory for the public access channels. The ruling stated that New York state law regarding public access channel administration or any other state laws were not touched specifically by the decision, which turned on whether Manhattan Neighborhoods Network was deemed to be a state actor because of its operation of a designated public forum. The majority found that a private company did not meet the same obligations under the First Amendment because channel operation wasn't exclusively a government function. The ruling also clearly states that a public access channel operated by a local government would be subject to First Amendment scrutiny. So what does this all mean? In this modern age of media, where we are uploading information that is displayed on the internet, the information that is uploaded, if it's through a state actor, it is subject to the First Amendment. If the operation is not run by state operators or by private an entity, the First Amendment does not apply. What does this mean for you and your community? The ruling did not examine local and state laws governing public access administration. Further, if local performance agreements or ordinance codify how your channels operate, you have this as both a guide and a liability shield. There are plenty of other questions it raises, though. How does it affect media liability on a channel? If a viewer complains about content on a public access channel, is a private operator now at risk of liability that the content is their speech? Could a private access channel operator now exercise viewpoint discrimination to silent voices it doesn't like? Perhaps. But again, something other than the First Amendment has to protect speakers from that type of editorial restraint according to this ruling. What the ruling also means is channels should have clearly written and easily understood policies for both managing content on channels and discipline of producers. Home Automation by Marty Winston on replacing lighting fixtures with modern LED technology.
The next time you're stopped in traffic, take a good look at the brake lights on the car in front of you, especially that back window brake light. For a lot of cars, what you'll see is a row of red dots. Each dot is an LED emitter. If one dot fails, the assembly is still an effective brake light. A lot of LED light bulbs, not all, but a good many, have more than one LED emitter inside. That way, an individual emitter doesn't have to do all the heavy lifting of delivering the full brightness of the bulb. Spreading that work also means those individual emitters, each handling just its fraction of the job, are significantly less expensive to manufacture. So, most LED light bulbs are not simply a really bright white LED in a bulb-shaped encasement. The insides of that bulb include some number of emitters and the electrical circuitry needed to convert the line power coming into the bulb into the kind of power that's needed to drive the emitters. In short, a power supply. And an LED is a DC, direct current device. Line power is AC, alternating current. Part of what happens inside the bulb involves changing AC into DC. That almost always requires a specific kind of passive electronic component called a capacitor. And in LED bulbs, that's almost always an electrolytic capacitor. When an LED bulb fails, it's almost always because the electrolytic capacitor fails. It's generally the first thing to go. Want to know why? Well, think about a jelly roll. You know, the slice of pastry that has a spiral of jellied fruit inside a spiral of cake. They make those by taking a broad but thin sheet of cake, adding a layer of the fruity filling, rolling it all from one end to the other into sort of a log shape, then cutting the slices into the pastry that's on your plate. Well, the first electrolytic capacitors were made with top and bottom layers of metal foil separated by a layer of wax paper. The whole thing rolled up and sealed, and in the early days, then dipped into wax, or sealed in wax-dipped paper, or sealed in a wax-dipped cardboard tube. So, what could possibly go wrong? Well, mostly aging, or sometimes cutting corners in designing the circuit or specifying the components. If circumstances allow too much energy to be there, that can punch holes in the dielectric layer, the layer that in the old days was wax paper, and that changes the nature of the capacitor in a way that leads to failure, sometimes immediately. LED bulbs are really just the first generation of LED lighting, and they put more of an emphasis on convenience than on performance. If you've ever in your life changed a light bulb, changing to an LED bulb is that same familiar exercise happening, hey, just one more time. You can take almost any old light fixture and retrofit it with an LED bulb with no need to even think about rewiring or replacing the fixture. But what if you didn't have to put a new bulb into the socket of a fixture? What if the fixture didn't need a bulb? In a sense, the fixture could be the bulb. Not any shape. Well, yes, any shape bulb, any size bulb. It could incorporate any reasonable number of LED emitters, the points of light inside LED lighting. It would need some nature of interface and perhaps control circuitry, but the power supply could be a separate thing. And that exactly describes most contemporary LED fixtures, especially, but not entirely, outside of residential LED fixtures. Some large number of emitters are embedded forever into the fixture, along with some fundamental circuitry to address them. With bulbs, the little power supplies are inside, for example, in the little neck of a standard round bulb, between the screw-in part and the round bulge of a bulb part. With fixtures, the power supply is in a separate module, sometimes an attached module, called a driver. It's often a separate item, but it is also sometimes either attached to or within the fixture. It's called a driver. There's a third module, sometimes built into the driver, called a controller. That is a kind of adjustment. It lets the fixture respond to commands to turn on, turn off, dim, and so on. The fixture might also incorporate some bonus features like sensors, so it only turns on when light is needed, like, you know, when it's dark or the ambient light is too dim or a tornado is passing by, or it might have motion detectors or occupancy sensors or vacancy sensors, so it doesn't turn on when light wouldn't be helping anyone. It's a fun principle to remember. No humans, no lumens. No humans, no lumens. Anyway, those are the building blocks, but you may not yet have a sense of what they look like. 20 years ago, when you went into a workshop or garage or school or a lot of commercial spaces, the lighting you saw on the ceiling involved fluorescent tubes, either naked to the world, just hanging there, or in shallow metal boxes with a plastic diffuser to help spread the light out. You might have noted that in one sense, those boxes are built as more or less an upside-down trough. If you think of them that way, it may be easier to remember what they're called. They're called troffers, but spelled T-R-O-F-F-E-R-S, troffers, which have become a mainstay shape for many of today's commercial and industrial LED fixtures. Makes sense. Think about it. LED bulbs were made to fit where other older bulbs went because the retrofit was easy and immediate. LED fixtures can go where troffers have been, so they're an easy retrofit for facilities that have been using fluorescent troffers but now want to go all LED. And make no mistake, that's an easy decision. LED fixtures use only a fraction of the energy of fluorescent bulbs, so there's a small savings there. They also generate less heat. But the biggest savings is in the labor cost of the maintenance worker who would have to climb a ladder or scaffold to change burned-out fluorescent tubes as they failed in each of what was often scores of troffers in a facility. 10, 20, 50, 100 troffers to light a big plant floor, and every time one fails, the guy's in a cherry picker or up a ladder. That's expensive. You're paying that fellow a decent living wage. Many troffers are free-hanging chained lights, but many more fit into the grid of, yes, you've been there, a suspended ceiling. Since most grids, suspended ceiling grids, involve 2-foot by 2-foot spacing or a multiple of that, most troffers are 2 feet by 2 feet or 2 feet by 4 feet. While a lot of LED fixtures are troffer retrofits, a lot of others go in different directions. Solid or flexible lighting tapes or strips, think of them as roughly half an inch wide with LED emitters running along their length. Well, those things make a lot of other geometries easy. Hide them in a cove ceiling for a dramatic way to both accent the coves and light the room. Many are designed to run along the edges of ceilings or tops of walls or under counters. They look very cool. The light looks very cool, and they accomplish a lot of lighting chores efficiently while not looking anything at all like any technology of light that came before them. So, what if you took a circle or square? This is yet another variation. What if you took a circle or square and put one of those tapes, one of those ribbons of LED emitters, around its inside rim? Now, you put it there, and you made it there with a glass or glass-like diffuser. And just for kicks, add a sheet of tiny micro lenses on the back of that glass. Turn those LED emitters on, and it looks like the whole surface of that skinny circle or square of glass and diffuser is simply aglow with bright illumination. That's called edge lighting, and it's one of my favorite forms of LED lights. But there really aren't many limits. What shape do you want? Where do you want it? What kind of light do you want to put out? What flavor of white? What colors? Just about anything you can imagine can get implemented as an LED fixture. Try doing that with fluorescent lights or neon lights or incandescent bulbs. You just don't have the flexibility, and you're going to burn a lot more cost. I said that LED bulbs were the first generation of LED lighting. LED fixtures are the second generation, and it's already in place. It's happening now. I could tell you about the next generation, but it's not here yet, so until it gets reasonable, let's not worry about it. I think today's LED fixtures will stay viable for another 50 years. And that's a good thing, since some of them have that long a life expectancy, even if they spend more time on than off. Anyway, think of all the places artificial light has changed all of our lives. And with what you now know about these fixtures, I think it's fair to predict that where lighting led, leads light. Next time, I'll introduce you to what I know about something the energy utilities call sustainability. It means, for example, how the gas company finds new sources for producing gas so the planet doesn't run out of gas. I can even promise that we'll talk a little trash.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, The club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on providing computer support to fulfill and to help manage volunteers. Thursday, June the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, July 2nd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets on Friday, July 5th. They meet at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Kingsbite Computer Club meets Tuesday, July 9th. They meet at 7 p.m., and they gather at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple Seeds and Apple Devices Thursday, July 11th, and they meet at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and their location is 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on recycling e-waste and pioneering urban sustainability Thursday, July 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on web design Thursday, July 11th, and the presentation is at 7 p.m., and this was originally rescheduled from the first week of July 4th. Obviously, it's a national holiday, so they moved it to the following week. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, July 12th at 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, and it's located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, July the 23rd, and they meet at 7 p.m., and it's at the Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.